Banjo-Kazooie is fondly remembered as a cornerstone title for the N64, the legendary Nintendo console that also brought us Super Mario 64, Ocarina of Time, and heaps of other classics. Rare, the developers behind Banjo-Kazooie, already had a glowing reputation for high-quality games. The release of Banjo proved to be no exception, as it's now held up as one of the founding fathers of 3D platforming, helped in no small part by its attractive graphics, inspired level design, and memorable music. The music wasn't just memorable either, but has become famous for its dynamic nature. A single level features several variations on a main theme, which fades seamlessly between one another as you explore different areas. The effect is stunning and makes Banjo-Kazooie a delightfully immersive experience. Yet, aside from its technical innovations, its soundtrack bursts with pure melody and the colourful wonder that the game cries out for. None of this is surprising to fans of VGM when they learn who brought it all together. Grant Kirkhope. Rightly considered among the very finest video game composers, Grant has put his name to more games than you can count. That is, without getting distracted by actually listening to some of his work and giving up, as I did several times when researching for this episode. I'm Lee Tyrrell, and this is The Sound Test, where I look in-depth into video game audio and music, along with the very people who crafted it. In this episode, I'm joined by Grant Kirkhope himself to dissect his work on the entire Banjo-Kazooie series. And in its beginnings, Grant wasn't nearly as established as he is today.
Bear in mind that, you know, Banjo-Kazooie was my second game, really. Like, I did the Game Boy conversion of Dave Wise's tunes on Diddy Kong's Quest, and then I did GoldenEye. But Banjo was my first game by myself.
Considering he was working for Rare, that brought with it an enormous pressure. Games like the Donkey Kong Country series were particularly lauded for their audio, which was mostly handled by David Wise. You can hear some more about Grant and David's work on those games in an upcoming episode, but looking at Rare's in-house composers at the time of Banjo's release reads like a who's who of video game musicians, with names like David Wise, Graham Norgate, Robin Beanland, and Grant under their wing. Rare had some of the very best audio on the market.
I think Rare always went the extra mile in those days. That's why Rare became such a strong force, and you know, in that kind of the golden age of Rare, which was, you know, back then. That's, you know, we always, you know, Tim Stamper, Chris Stamper, they pushed us always to do the extra bit. On the Game Boy, even we'd try and push it a bit further. On the N64, we'd try and push it a bit further, try and get as much out of it as we could. You know, squeeze every last ounce of processing power out of it.
It was going that extra mile that led Rare and Grant to the idea of dynamic soundtracks that change and react to wherever you are in any one level. This has been among the most enduring features of Banjo-Kazooie's music, but Grant's the first to admit that it wasn't entirely his idea, or even the Stamper brothers.
We just stole it all, of course, from somebody else, like you do. So when I first got to Rare, Tim Stamper, one of the bosses, and Greg Males, who's the kind of head designer forever at Rare, they loved all the LucasArts games, but in particular the Secret of Monkey Island games. And LucasArts had that thing called iMuse, which is like I-M-U-S-E, which is their system for fading, you know, tunes together. And they were like, this is fantastic, we need to do this. You need to work out how it works. And I was like, ugh. So, that's what we got it from there. So we just had to make it work with the N64. So that was the trick.
LucasArts developed and implemented iMuse in 1991, instantly putting it to work in Monkey Island 2, LeChuck's Revenge. Its creators, Michael Land and Peter McConnell, have apparently commented that, despite their hard work, barely anybody noticed it. This is probably more of a comment on just how well it was done. The following music is an example of how it sounded, with each transition representing the player moving between different buildings. So how did Grant adapt this concept for the N64 and Banjo-Kazooie?
The principle is exactly the same. It's just that in a MIDI file, you have like 16 tracks, right? So usually you get one instrument per track. So we worked out that we could control the volume of each individual track or channels in software. So let's say there's four areas in the level I was trying to write music for. I'd allocate certain tracks to certain levels, certain parts of the level. So, you know, say tracks 1 to 3 would be part 1, tracks 4 to 10 would be part 4, you know, that kind of way. So, and then the programmer would draw like circles over the areas in the level, which you can't see, of course. And when you cross that line, it would trigger the channel fade. So it would turn down, you know, tracks 1 to 4 and fade up tracks 5 to 10 and whatever it was. And that's how it worked. So when you had the MIDI file playing all at once, it was a bright racket because it was all the instruments playing at once. So it was all like that. That's how it worked. And there was always like a single channel, usually for the harp, because that was always for underwater. So I guess there was like 15 channels, maybe. You know, it had to be economical. You know what I mean? It was tricky to get it to sound full, you know, and to get it to work. But you know, it worked out great. So we were super proud of that.
Let's take a listen at how some of these transitions might work. In this case, on an early level, Mumbo's Mountain. First off, you have the main piece, on which all of the others are based. Then, if you approach Mumbo's hut, the tune takes on a tribal edge. Getting close to Ticker's tower triggers a military snare drum and a cartoonish voice. Entering Conga's Patch brings in a driving tom beat and what sounds like a bassoon. Finally, leaping underwater washes off everything but the reverberating plucks of a harp. Each of these distinct styles sticks strictly to the underlying main theme, allowing well-automated fades to make any transition comfortable and natural. The only time a technical limitation makes itself known in-game is in the ambitious Grunty's lair, the game's hub world. For Grunty's lair, there's the potential for no less than 11 variations on a central theme. One for each of the game's levels, and a couple of other versions too, just for fun.
Back then we all thought it was an enjoyable challenge, but I guess it was down to me and one programmer guy that kind of got it all working. And we realised that there wasn't enough channels in a single MIDI file to cover all the areas in Grunty's Lair, so it couldn't continually play. So at some points it would restart and go to the next version. So there'd always be the main theme, the main version of the theme in the MIDI file with several other variations. And so, as I say, we couldn't get all the variations into one MIDI file, so at some points it will restart. So that took a little bit of figuring out. But, you know, I guess once it got working, it got easier. We kind of realised that how we could do it, what we could do with it, you know, that kind of thing.
There are a lot of decisions to make behind all of the music itself, too. Totally away from any technical considerations. What key should it be in? What styles are appropriate? How does Grant settle on the right instrumentation, for example? What pace and rhythm will fit a player's actions and the feel of an evil witch's lair at the same time?
That was that kind of 6/8 sort of feel, right? And I just felt it fitted. I guess it's a bit Addams Family, and it, you know, I guess it just fitted the witch to me. That rhythm cries witch to me. That kind of that rhythm. It's a bit like The Sorcerer's Apprentice by Dukar, the original. You know, da 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 da. You know, I guess I got it from there, really. So that just seems to fit that kookiness of the witch, you know. You know, I don't know, I think as a composer, I think you just, some things just cry out to be a certain way. You know, you use an echoey marimba in a crab shell because it's going to be echoey and it's going to, you know, that kind of thing. You know, it's just obvious, I think. That idea pops into your head before you even start the music. I always say about, you know, spike instruments are going to be used for ice stuff like Celeste and pizzicato strings and glockenspiel, you know, because it's a spiky sound. And to me, it sounds like spiky things. And nice long woodwind notes are going to be used in a nice field somewhere. You know, just that stuff just, you know, it pops into your head straight away before you even write it.
But for those seemingly obvious choices, there's always a level behind it inspiring them. Something I've learned through creating the sound test is just how different composers are to one another, their level of access to information behind the scenes, and what they do with that information. These things are important to how the music eventually turns out. So how did it work for Grant at Rare?
I think you definitely take the level design into account, you know, so you get a brief from the designer, it might show you some artwork, you know, so, and they'll give you, tell you what it's all about. So, you know, I do, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, I guess like you look at something like Cloud Cuckoo Land, that was a bit of a weird one. So I tried to make it sound vaguely annoying. I felt like the level was vaguely annoying because it was like a bit crazy, and that the music should reflect it all, you know, without getting completely on your tits for the entire time, you know. So it's a bit like, I just think you look at something and just something pops into your head and off you go. That's the way it works for me, really.
After all these years, Grant has certainly shown himself to be effortlessly prolific. And you'd have to be for a game like Banjo-Kazooie, which demanded a lot of its composer. One level, Click Clock Woods, goes as far as changing its musical style depending on the season of the time. Spring features a bouncy flute and establishes the theme. When it switches to summer, the arrangement turns to sun-drenched strings in a waltz rhythm. Thank you. Autumn repackages the melody with a bassoon and some of the local wildlife. Mallet sounds, like glockenspiels and xylophones, take over in the winter, reflecting the choppy cold of its climate. Besides a tapestry of dynamic tunes, Banjo-Kazooie is filled with the obligatory short jingles that come with collectibles and completing levels. And then there's the perky track that kicks in when Kazooie dons her special wading boots. It's not their primary purpose, but ditties like Wading Boots and its sister song Turbo Trainers help to break the potential monotony of a looping level track.
Like, you can't have something like banging away like that forever, because people are going to get sick of it. So you have to have a, you know, you have to write different versions. So you might have a, you know, a normal level piece, but you're going to have a faster version for someone running around, perhaps, or something like that. In those days, it was easy just to speed it up, because it's just a MIDI file, right? So you sped it up and there's no pitch differences. But nowadays, because it's all stereo wave files, if you speed it up, it's just going to go like Mickey Mouse, right? So you can't do that now. It was easy to you could have sped it up in those days, but sometimes it wouldn't sound great. So I'd just write another version. So, you know, when Kazooie runs around with the trainers on and the music speeds up, I just wrote another tune that was just a bit faster. And it was the same melody in a faster arrangement. So, you know, it's just, I think it's just all that stuff you just mess around with until you get it right.
With all that, you'd think Grant would be exhausted. But even the frogs have been known to sing in Banjo Land. Why were details like this important when there's so much else going on? The sounds of birds and crickets give the world of Banjo-Kazooie another level of vibrancy and life. Where did the idea of some of the game's musical wildlife first come from?
I think Tim and Greg always wanted things to join in. They always thought it was cool when, like, you know, you'd hear creatures singing the tune or the birds chirping the tune, so I always tried to include it. So they just liked that. That was part of that. They were all, as I say, they were always going, let's try the new thing. Like, Tim was great for going, you'd do something, you'd come in and say, oh, that's great, what about this? And there was always that what about this thing he'd say, which make you go, oh God, that's a great idea. Like, that's the beauty of Tim Stamper. I think he's a bit of a crazy genius, I think. And, you know, the Stamper brothers were the backbone of Rare, and that's, Rare was the way it was because of them. I think that there was always that thing that they pushed it to do, and that was it. It just bled into everything, like into the music, into the sound effects, into the programming, the art style, a lot. And I think, you know, it was always that stuff that got you going.
With the Stamper brothers as an inspiration, sound design was very important to Banjo-Kazooie, which is exactly where its distinctive voices come from. Anyone who's played the game knows its unique gibberish speech, but its origins reach back further than the concept of Banjo himself. And putting it together came purely out of necessity.
We hit on the idea of, like, because we had no memory space, we couldn't fit any real actual talking in. We had to come up with another solution. Because when we were doing Dream, we did have, like, proper, like, people speaking in Dream, the game that turned into Banjo-Kazooie. You know, thinking we'd have memory space, and it just turned out we didn't. So when it got to be Banjo, we knew we had no space for anything. So we tried to find a way to make that stuff, you know, happen in the as small a memory footprint as possible. So that was the whole thing about it, and it was just trial and error, really. I just messed around until it sounded, you know, half decent. I mean, we all thought it was terrible at the time. You know, we just thought, oh my God, people are going to hate this.
But something about it clearly caught on, as people far from hated it. Instead, they found it funny and endearing, absolutely in the spirit of the game around it. Dream, the game that never was once in development for the Super Nintendo, before moving to the N64 and morphing into Banjo-Kazooie. Grant worked on Dream, which included composing music, but space limitations were a large reason why it was shelved. Though its plan for full-blown voice acting was called, at least until Conker's Bad Fur Day, it did result in the myriad of amusing voices sprinkled throughout Banjo. And, as it turns out, there's a remarkable amount of thought behind constructing good gibberish.
Some of the characters, like Banjo, had quite a lot of, not very many voice samples, because it didn't sound very good, but Kazooie had lots of voice samples. So it was trial and error. I realised that, what you'd do is you'd trigger a sample and you'd say, give it a random pitch, somewhere between, this level and this level kind of thing. And it would pick a pitch and play. But we soon found out that if the pitch, variation was too wide, it sounded weird, because the human voice hasn't got an awful lot of, pitch difference when you speak it. It doesn't go very high, it doesn't go very low, it's somewhere in the middle, reducing it to a narrow band like that. And then we also worked out that obviously the human voice can make one noise at a time, so you couldn't have samples that overlapped, because it wouldn't sound right. And also, we just get a rhythm going dirt, 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 didn't sound good either. It had to have some kind of weird rhythmic thing, as speech is, it's weird rhythmic stuff, isn't it? Yeah. So we realised that we triggered a sample on every syllable, on a word. So if we were more, if the sample was playing and the next syllable had started, it would cut the sample it was playing and go to the next sample. It started to sound a bit like gobbledygook speech. It kind of got that way in the end. But it took a little bit of work. It's things that you take for granted when you're speaking as a human being, but when you try to put it into kind of video game terms, it took a bit of messing around to get it to sound, half decent at best, so. It was funny, but when I went to see the guys in Paris to start doing Mario Rabbids Kingdom Battle, first meeting that I had with them in Paris, they were talking about how iconic the Banjo-Kazooie voices were, and how they, and I was just like, I can't believe anybody thinks it's iconic, because we were all like, God, this is bloody awful, people are going to hate it. And it's so bizarre how things just get, sucked up by people, and it became the sound of the game, and I guess people thought it was quite funny, and we just really bodged it in there to try and hope that it would be at least presentable. It's funny how things turn out like that.
Banjo-Kazooie truly is iconic, from its voices to its actual gameplay, and will remain platforming royalty as long as the genre survives. It owes a lot of that to Grant's work on the audio. Thanks to that success, a sequel soon appeared in the form of Banjo-Tooie, which featured a whole new palette of patented Kirkhope melodies. Bigger and arguably darker than its predecessor, Banjo-Tooie took clever advantage of several technical innovations to help increase its scope.
When it came to Banjo-Tooie, we realised we could stick two MIDI files together and keep track of both of them at the same time. So that then it meant I had 32 channels then. So I could do a lot more with it. So what's the funfair level called in Banjo-Tooie? Grunty's World? Something like that, is it?
Since Grant's worked on so many games, I think forgetting a name can be forgiven. But for the sake of accuracy, I believe he's referring to Witchy World.
But in that one, all the areas there, they all fade, and there's lots and lots of fades going on there, but it never restarts. It's the same MIDI file because it's two stuck together. So that was the pinnacle of the kind of channel fade thing we got to. It was on that level in Banjo-Tooie. So, I guess I probably got a bit more confident by Banjo-Tooie and thought, maybe I can actually do this job. I'm not that bad, So, I was just learning, I'd only been there a little while, I guess a couple of years at that point, but it was still only my really kind of third game, I suppose. So I think you're just learning, I'm still learning. I feel like I'm still learning now, really.
And there's definitely a different tone to Banjo-Tooie, though it comes clearly from the same landscape that N64 players already knew so well. Due to having some extra space to play with, it's a gigantic soundtrack too, spanning several hours of material. Having composed it still relatively early in his career, what does Grant think of Banjo-Tooie's music today?
I think Banjo-Tooie was... it just felt darker, and I felt it was too big as well. So we all felt like if we made it twice the size, it'd be twice as good, and it didn't really work that way. And I felt the levels were darker. It wasn't as jolly as Banjo 1. And I mean, you know, Sparrow Mountain's all blown up and to pieces, isn't it? So it's like, that's a sad version of that to start off with, you know. So I kind of felt you're a downer at the start. I guess you start to stretch your composing a little bit. You start, to try to incorporate new things, because I didn't want it just to be a rerun of Banjo 1. You know, I wanted to try and do stuff that was a bit different. So I felt Banjo 2 was different to Banjo 1. Like I said, it was probably a bit darker. I felt like I was a bit more adventurous, like harmonically. I guess you may not think that, but I felt that way. You know, Atlantis was brilliant. I love writing Atlantis for that game, because it was really nice, you know, underwatery, you know, kind of ambient tune. I loved writing that one. So there's bits in there, but I think you're right. I do feel like it seemed more in a minor key than major key to me.
Whatever your thoughts are on its music, which I consider to be incredible, Banjo-Tooie would be the last traditional platformer in the series, unless you count Grunty's Revenge, a much more niche title for the Game Boy Advance. The next home console release didn't drop until 2008 for the Xbox 360. Named Banjo-Kazooie Nuts and Bolts, gameplay this time centred around vehicle construction, with very little of the mechanics intact from either of the N64 releases. It received a mixed reception from players, but with Grant still on board, as his last job for Rare, you could at least rely on the audio.
Yeah, that was a bit of a strange one, I suppose. I knew I was going to be leaving Rare at that point. So, it was like, I wanted to make sure I revisited enough of the music in the original game so it still had that feel to it. So, my idea was to always kind of put in a quote from the original game somewhere. So a lot of the music in Nuts and Bolts does have a little reference to, tunes in the past, you know. And the plan was I wanted to do all the music in that game. Give the sound effects to somebody else. But I ran out of time because I was doing Viva Piñata 2 at the same time. So I asked Dave Klinik and Robin Beanland to help me out on Banjo Nuts and Bolts.
Both David Klinik and Robin Beanland are well respected for their work with Rare, just like Grant. David has been involved in mixing the audio of several of their titles, though he wrote great music for the Perfect Dark series, Banjo Nuts and Bolts, and many more. Robin's history with Rare can be traced back to the very first Donkey Kong Country, but he's well known for games like Killer Instinct, Conker's Bad Fur Day, and most recently, Sea of Thieves. As such, Grant's collaborators for Nuts and Bolts couldn't have been better suited to the task.
And the original plan was for me to write the main theme for all the levels and those two to do the variations. But it didn't really work out like that. Robin said, it wasn't really working, so he wanted to write some of his own melodies for the levels. I said, fantastic. So he took some levels and did that. He did his own stuff. But he still quoted some of the original game music in the new stuff as well.
Though Grant shared the load this time around, he found the time for one final salute to the whole series with Banjo Land, a fully orchestrated medley that pays tribute to many of the series' most popular tunes.
That was the one that I just stuck all, as many as I could together, to kind of write that kind of, my last goodbye to Banjo in a way, you know, so it got all the tunes from a lot of the tunes from the first two games, stuck them all together in one big piece, and it kind of plays in that level.
The medley includes, in order of their appearance, references to Click Clock Woods, Freeze Easy Peak, Mad Monster Mansion, Gobi's Valley, Cloud Cuckoo Land, Mayhem Temple, and Rusty Bucket Bay. A magnificent exclamation mark at the end of Grant's work with Banjo-Kazooie, Banjoland is a triumphant listen for fans. Many of those fans will have been children in the 90s, like myself. Now adult and profoundly affected by the melodies of youth. I can only speak from personal experience, but I know that video game music by Grant Kirkhope and his colleagues informed much of my general listening and introduced me to a wealth of sounds and textures that I wouldn't have heard otherwise. In that sense, VGM can be even more powerful than pop charts. Has Grant ever considered how deeply influential game music can be to a player?
Well, at the time, no, definitely not. But in years gone by, I've realised that it has done, you know, a lot of games have done that to kids. Like, I look at my own kid, right, Max is 15 and a half. He listens to no popular music whatsoever. Like, his only playlist is usually, it's game soundtracks, and maybe movie soundtracks, but primarily game soundtracks. He has no interest in any popular music whatsoever, which is, when I was a kid that age, it was all about the pop charts, you know, when I was a kid then. You know, so it's kind of really... It's so weird how it's happened. And it's, you know, video game music's got so big, it's just incredible, really. And I kind of feel you hear it bleeding into pop records these days. You hear lots of, like, Game Boy references and things like that. It's so bizarre how it's happened. So, at the start, I definitely didn't think that, but now I do. I sort of feel that in some respects video games music has reintroduced a whole generation to just instrumental music, you know, without vocals. People are accustomed to listening to music with someone singing, usually, unless you're into, you know, orchestral music or whatever, or, you know, that kind of stuff. So I do feel that it introduced a lot, several generations of kids to just instrumental music, which is fantastic, really. You get kids wanting to go see an orchestra playing video game tunes now, which is fantastic. Can you imagine a parent sat there going, your kids going, Mum, I want to go and watch the symphony orchestra. They're like, are you crazy? You know, they can't believe it, you know. It's been such a brilliant thing that people have, again, listened to just purely instrumental music.
After the Banjo series, Grant carried the flame into its spiritual sequel, Yooka-Laylee, alongside David Wise and Steve Burke. It's definitely something that fans of Banjo-Kazooie should check out, but Grant and I unfortunately didn't have the time to cover any questions about it. The reason why is essentially good news, as it means you'll be hearing Grant a further 3 times on this podcast. In my time with him, I simply had to ask him about GoldenEye 007, his latest soundtrack for Mario and Rabbids, and of course, his contributions to Donkey Kong Country. Thanks to Grant for speaking to me for the sound test, but thank you too for taking the time to listen. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please make sure to subscribe or follow on whatever platform you might be listening on. There will be a new episode each week, with next week's looking at the Oddworld series with one of its regular composers, Michael Bross. I grew up playing Oddworld's first games with my dad, and you can actually hear the episode straight away, ahead of its official release. All our Patreon supporters can receive this early access for a single dollar, so head on over to patreon.com/_secretcave if you'd like to pledge your support and hear next week's episode right now. Of course, this doesn't apply if you're already a patron and hearing this episode in advance.